Welcome to the Planning Commission meeting of July 3rd, 2012. Debbie, could we have roll call, please? Here.
Here.
Here. Here. And we will have the flag salute led by Commissioner Keene.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And next up on the agenda takes us to item 4, which is agenda review. Do any of the commissioners have any reason to revise the order of the agenda? No? Okay. And that takes us to item 5, community comments and suggestions. This is the portion of the meeting where people can comment on items that are not on the agenda. If anybody would like to come up and do that, they're now welcome to. Okay. Then we'll bring it back. And written communications, we were handed written communications from Debbie when we first arrived. And let's see. Okay. It was a continuance, a request for continuance given by planner Ryan Foster. Memo from Ryan Foster to the Planning Commission dated July 3rd, requesting a continuance for item 8A. And then that brings us to the consent agenda, which we have the approval of minutes from June 19th, 2012. Did any commissioners have any changes to that?
I do.
Okay, go ahead, John.
Under 8B, it's on page 3, second paragraph, says Commissioners Keene, Ruth and Keene stated they attended the meeting, architecture review meeting. That is one of the ones that I did not attend, and I may have said something that alluded to that, but I did not attend that ARC meeting. Thank
you. Thanks, John. Anyone else? Then I will entertain a motion to approve those minutes with John's change.
So moved.
Second.
Chair, Vice Chair Farnage.
Yes. Okay, and that takes us to our public hearings. Item 8 and item 8A is amended tentative parcel map number 12-001 and amended plan unit development number 12-001. And I believe that that is being continued to a date certain.
The applicant requested continuance. We'd like it continued to the August 7th meeting.
Yes. Okay. And then do we need a motion to continue? Okay.
So moved.
Second.
Roll call, please, Debbie.
Commissioner Keene?
Yes.
Commissioner Sparrow?
Yes.
Commissioner Martin?
Yes.
Vice Chair Barnage?
Yes. Okay, and then that takes us to a continued item, 8B, which is consideration of variance number 12-001 and view shed review number 12-001. Allowing the deviation from front and side yard setback requirements for the construction of a three-car garage and second-story dwelling, the applicant
Obviously, this is a continued item from the last meeting on the 19th of June. Since most of you were at that meeting, this may sound a little redundant to you, but since Commissioner Sparrow wasn't there, we'll go back through the entire thing. So here's the project location. It's located at 186 South Elm Street. It's on the west-hand side of Elm near the intersection of Elm and Maple. a little bit of background about the project. Back in November of 2007, the City Council rezoned 13 properties on South Elm Street, including the subject property. They went from single-family to multifamily. This left a lot of single-family-sized lots that must conform to multifamily development standards. For example, the subject property is 50 feet wide, whereas the multifamily standard is 80 feet. Currently, the site is non-conforming due to its lack of a two-car garage for the primary residence, which is a standard of the municipal code. And it must be made conforming before any additional expansions can occur. And again, this was the public hearing was continued by the Planning Commission on the 19th of June. So as you said, the allow for the deviation of that setback. And the table below actually shows the comparison of standards for single-family and multifamily compared to the proposed setbacks. The village residential setback standards are actually just included to give you kind of an idea that this is something that we do allow in other parts of the city. So here is an overview of the proposal. As you can see, the 5-foot setback deviation is requested on the south side of the property between the new 3-car garage and dwelling unit and the property boundary, and then the 15-foot setback from 20 down to 15 is requested toward South Elm Street. Here are some additions that, since the last meeting, the applicants are proposing. They decided to go more with architectural features to try and mitigate some of the massing that the Planning Commission was concerned with at the previous meeting. This choice was made partly due to the fact that they feel very strongly with their current landscape plan and the feeling behind it and the way it routes you throughout the site, but also still have a building massing issue. So they've actually proposed to go forward with some architectural features, including they've stepped the front portion of the garage back about 12 inches, I believe, from the north side of the new building. They are proposing pop-out windows along the above the garage as well as the upper portion, the sidewalk side of the project. And as you can see, they're also bumping out and kind of creating a little bit more of an enclosure of the front entranceway to kind of highlight that in an attempt to break up all the massing. I included a landscape plan this time. As you can see, this is updated. They do have the additional street tree down at the southwest portion of the project. Other than that, the landscaping is the same that the commission reviewed last time. Currently, the site, this front portion of the site, is all dirt, and the remainder of it is also pretty much unimproved. ...62 and 160 South Elm all have been built within the 20-foot setback. While I haven't actually gone out and measured the exact where they're at due to, I don't want to step on anybody else's, you know, property, but they're clearly within 20 feet of the front property line. Additionally, here are some images of side yard setback deviations nearby. 190 is the property directly south, and 194 South Elm is two properties south, and that is actually a two-story apartment building that's built within 5 feet of the property line. Additionally, the applicant had gone around and made note of the surrounding neighborhood and some of the two-story massings that appear to be right within the 20-foot front yard setback, including properties at 266 Aspen, 163 Spruce, 249 South Elm, and 191 South Elm, which is actually directly across the site from the project site. Due to commissioner concern during the previous review of the project. Staff went out and took pictures of the adjacent property. There are currently three. Window that is currently covered up by cardboard. There are no drapes in that window. This was a supplemental portion of the memo in the previous review. However, staff has included it in the staff report this time. But because it's a continued item, we didn't change the actual resolution. And the commission seemed to kind of go along and support the calculation of density, as I'll highlight now. So the proposed project under the multifamily density calculations actually comes out to 1.5 dwelling units. Based on the size of the site indicated on the project plans, they are allowed 1.45 dwelling units. Based on the community development director's interpretation of the rounding provisions of the municipal code, we are proposing to the commission to round up, to be able to round that to 1.5. Commissioner Martin actually pointed out that according to the tax assessor's website, the property is listed at 7,275 square feet, which calculates to 1.5 dwelling units anyway. So according to what the this morning, the applicant and one of the commissioners kind of identified an additional alternative. Last time during the review, I believe one of the commissioners asked what the building code standard is for building separation. I actually reported that it's a 10-foot standard when, in fact, that's just the municipal code standard. The California building code requires you can be within 6 feet as long as both of the structures are fire sprinklered, which the main residence is fire sprinklered, and the new dwelling unit will be. However, going closer than 6 feet requires additional upgrades to firewalls and that sort of thing. So there is another alternative to possibly move the structure back toward the main residence a tiny bit to help with the reduction of front yard setbacks. Based on the scaling of the site, grade differentials, and that sort of thing, if that's something that the commission would like to kind of move forward with, staff would recommend only reducing the distance between the structures by 2 feet. That would make the new front yard did recommend approval of the project as it was originally presented to them. They also supported placement of the structure on the site as well as the variance request. The project has been determined to be categorically exempt per sections 15305A and 15332B of the California Environmental Quality Act guidelines. This relates to minor alterations in land use limitations as well as infill development projects. So public notices were mailed out to all property owners within 300 feet of the project site on June 8th, as well as being published in the Telegram Tribune and posted at City Hall. Public hearing items continued to a date certain, do not require additional noticing. Had we continued it to a date uncertain, we would have re-noticed everybody. But and actually, there have been comments received by staff. One of the property owners nearby came in to look at the plans, and after review, stated that he fully supported the project, felt that it would be a great asset to that portion of the neighborhood and can spur some positive change in that area. At this time, staff and the ARC recommend that the planning restriction between not allowing the two structures to be rented out separately. So, if the commission still supports that in their final motion, that would be a point to remove that. And that concludes the staff report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Matthew. Do any of the commissioners have questions for Matthew? Staff?
I have one question.
Go ahead, Jen.
The property, two properties south, 194 that you mentioned, do you have any idea what the setback is on that?
On the front half?
On the front. You mentioned the side.
It's kind of hard to tell because of the landscaping, and depending on whether you measure by the stairs that access the structure or the main portion of the structure itself. I would guess it's somewhere around 15 and 20 feet. It seems to be right at kind of that line.
Okay. That's it.
And I would even err that's probably closer to 20 feet.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Matthew. Do you have any questions, Lisa? Matthew, could you put up the slides of those new photos that you, I think you took the other And we always ask the applicant if you would like to come first. So go ahead and come up, if you will, please. Welcome.
My name is Mitchell Wallace, and as I stated at the last meeting, my wife and I are the owners of the subject property. After the last meeting, we took a lot of the elements that were recommended, and we incorporated those into the plan. We tried to incorporate everything that we could, all the recommendations that would fit within the scope of the project. When it comes to the actual setback requirement of the front, I know that was something that, you know, there's just not a lot of space on the project site. There's just, you know, we can't really take space out of the garage because then it's not really a viable garage for a tenant. We can't really, you know, we came up with a way that we might be able to bring the buildings a little bit closer together to establish a little bit more space in the front. We can't really take space out of the stairwell. You're not going to be able to get a couch or a queen bed up. There's just not a lot of space. So we did everything that we could to try to reduce the impact of that front yard setback. I also brought the designer.
Of moving it back the additional 2 feet and having the 8 feet between the, would that be an acceptable change?
Definitely, yes.
Okay. That was my question as well. Any more questions, John? Jennifer? No? Okay.
I do have a question. Sorry. With the changes to the front and the bump outs, are those bumping out a foot? Is it at 14 now, but... I mean, I appreciate what you're trying to do because I think it helps, but just trying to be clear if we have some leeway in moving that this came out about a foot.
Yeah, they did, and we incorporated those, again, to help limit the massing of the structure. In talking with the designer, we could probably maybe bring those back to six inches. Mm-hmm. It just, you know, starts to kind of lose the effect. Mm-hmm. It's not something that has to be there, so if you feel like that it's something that we can go without, then we're fine with eliminating it. Like I said, we're just trying to come up with something that everybody's agreeable upon.
Okay. And your designer have anything to add, or did you want to just see if we had any questions?
Yeah, he really just...
Okay. And then, is there anyone else who would like to come forward and speak on this item? Go ahead and do so. Thank you.
Commission staff, thank you. Good evening. Dave Robichotti, 178 South Elm Street. I step in front of you tonight to urge you to push this project through. When Teresa and I had worked on rezoning this area to multifamily, this is kind of what we had envisioned, is that bringing an older neighborhood into the modern, into the modern scope of the city. You know, I have the largest lot on that area, but a real small house. All the houses have different setbacks, they have different styles, and this is a perfect fit. I understand the concerns on the setback for the garage, but at the same time, if you don't give that setback for the garage or take that space away, you just add another vehicle to the street. And that's, you know, and parking is an issue on
My name is Mike Relia, and my family owns the property directly to the right-hand side of this house at 180 South Elm Street. And we fully agree with everything that they're trying to do as well. We were happy to see when things were rezoned differently there, and it's something that we would like to look into the future of possibly doing something in the backyard at our property as well. So we are for the project as well. Thank you.
Excuse me, did you say north or south of this
property? It's on the north side, looking at the right-hand side, 180 South Elm Street.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to come forward and speak on this item? Nope. Okay, we'll close the portion of that and bring it back to the commission. Do we want to go to comments, or does anyone have any additional questions?
I have a quick question.
Okay.
Staff, maybe. Do we have anywhere in the code where there's a differentiation that
we have a structure setback
structure
only,
setback.
And then the accessory structure is so small that it doesn't require a building permit. We don't count those less than 120 square feet.
Okay. Thanks, Teresa. Jennifer, you want to go ahead? Start?
Sure.
Okay.
I like the changes. I think the south side, I think adding some windows in there, whether there's a house there or not, will be appreciated. I'm a little concerned on the depth of your garage. I think the intent there was to bump to articulate that face on the north side. So I don't have an issue with that one way or the other. I would just want to make sure that you can actually fit a car, you know, today's car in there, not a Prius. Although I like Prius. Anyway, so that was just a concern of mine. And on the setback, again, I'll just state that I think for multifamily high density, I'm okay with the 15 feet. It's not a garage setback. I think if be in favor of maybe kind of a mix of, it seems like if we can pull the house back 2 feet, I'd leave the bump outs at the front, so I don't know where that leaves us. It was really 14, but then we go back 2, so what, we're really at 16. I don't know if the front setbacks in multifamily have always been 20 feet.
I believe they have in previous editions of the municipal code. They have been pretty standard at 20 feet. To address your bump out concern, there is a provision in the municipal code that architectural features such as this can protrude up to 3 feet into required setbacks. Granted, the variance is already going 5 feet into the 20-foot setback, but approving the variance sets the new setback at 15 feet.
Okay.
And so therefore, protruding the pop out in 12 inches or 6 inches or however it is allowed under the municipal code.
Okay, and there's no height? That doesn't have to be something below? Okay, that's great. And I would imagine if somebody came in to develop this in a different manner, they could come in and almost do a PUD in a different style, and then that would go to maybe
Thanks, Jennifer. You're welcome. John, do you want to go ahead with comments?
Yeah. I really appreciate what you've done with the looks of the house. It really solve the massing problem that I had a problem with. The front setback is a problem for me, you know that, and I think that the 2 foot is probably a solution. I just don't like giving variances to a neighborhood that staggers them closer to the street, where it just changes the view from the other house, especially when on that side, the south side, it's you know, you've only got 10 foot between the houses. So that's my main problem. When you get on Google Earth and look at the front and put a straight edge between the main body structure of the two-story apartments, the house next door to yours, and the house on the story apartments, of course, are ahead of that, encroaching into that 20-foot. And then at the top of the stairs, on the south side of the stair casing, or whatever you want to call it, they did build out over the stairs. But the main body of the structure is in an exact line, the 20-foot, with the other three houses adjacent to this. And it's kind of confusing here until you read the notes on your plan. You show 32-foot on that house. Well, that's not the house. That's the garage. And it does state that in the fine little print notes. But when you look at that, that house is actually out at 20 foot, the front of it. Okay, the houses that we compare this to down the street, the 162, 160, blah, 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 we say that they were built in the front setback. I don't believe that they were. I think the road was widened and stretched back to those houses after they were built. So those I can't consider as part of justifying Would you put up the plot plan of this project? The one that shows the car backing out, the arc thing. Okay. Well, the drive there is 14 foot, and which is smaller than a car, but I know when you back out of the garage, it's going to hang over the edge into the landscaping. The problem is not the two-car garage, because you've got an arc there. It's this one backing out and this one pulling in, because the door is so narrow you don't have that swing. And so I'm wondering if the pointer works. If that drive only being 14 foot may need to be widened a little bit to get this car in and out of the single car garage.
Talk about that. I think that I asked about that as well, and I think the landscape plan it's actually, look, it's shown all the way straight.
Okay.
So I think there's more like 20 feet there.
Okay.
That's a concern.
I'm not going to stop the project for that, but I need for you to look into that to make sure that in the single car garage, the car has room enough to get in and out without jacking back and forth three or four times. Like I say, I really appreciate the changes you made, and the location of that street tree that Commissioner Barney's talked about, that right there, this house here has a wall right on the front back of sidewalk. And if that tree is pulled too far close to that property line, I'm afraid there could be a conflict there sometime. I know that there's a dirt area between the sidewalk and there, but I'm wondering if it ought to come back just a hair. They have it back 5 foot, but I understand the problem. I would vote to approve the project.
Thank you, John. Lisa?
Yes, I agree with most of the comments I've heard earlier as well. I mean, I think it would be nice to have more of a setback, but I do think it's a nice project and you need the room. So I think with the additional 2 feet, that kind of is a nice compromise. I agree. I think it's nice you have the support of your neighbors, and I think it will be a nice addition to the neighborhood, so I'm prepared to support it.
Thank you, Lisa. And I agree with most of what the commissioners have said. I appreciate the extra work in the architectural details that you added. That really helps a lot. And I also appreciate the palette, the landscape palette that you included. I don't have any doubt it's going to be a nice remodel and a nice yard. The 2 feet, I think that's, and you're okay with that, and I think backing it up 2 feet will, you know, any little bit helps. I think that the trees that you have out there, and what really changed my mind is looking across the street at the PUDs that are there, the newer ones, a couple years old with the oak trees. That project's beautiful, and it's really close to the street. So I'm ready to move forward tonight. And so if anybody doesn't have anything else to add, then I'll entertain a motion.
Question about the trees. It's
Yes, not my area,
but no. I thought we talked about, is there a a distance for street trees or every so many feet? I thought last time we settled on one street tree and the tree in front of the building.
Yes, and if there isn't enough space for an extra street tree, admittedly, I didn't look for the specific distance requirements. That would be required to be put onto the project site, somewhere near that corner of the project site, just because it was part of the ARC recommendations to add an extra either tree on site or street tree. So,
okay, because we talked about that, and there's already we talked about bringing the one tree close to the building more out.
This southern one would be almost right at the property line. As Commissioner Martin pointed out, I believe this is about 20 feet. Their lot's only 50 feet wide, so
about
25 feet, give or take.
Okay. Because, 25 feet, that's okay. That we see that. We plant trees that close together. But if you're talking 10, 12 feet, that's really pushing it. So maybe if you could just check. And then Jennifer did bring up the point. I can't remember where we left that tree in the middle of that planted area, because now it's right on the corner of the garage, which is maybe okay, but we thought maybe centering it in the lawn might be a little bit, the landscape area might be a little better to soften the two-story structure. And it would be further away from the building, which might be a good idea because it seems like it's right next to the building.
I listened to the audio from last meeting. There was no real formal recommendation. There were many ideas of additional tree locations pointed out.
Okay. So is that okay with the math? You'll check on
sure.
the spacing?
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
I would add in as part of the motion of approval, if that's the way the commission seems like they're going. So the change to number six to remove additionally the pushing back of the structure 2 feet, and then to request that staff work with the applicant on the placement of the street trees.
Motion?
As soon as I find the page.
Okay.
I move we adopt a resolution of the Planning Commission of the City of Rio Grande approving variance 12001 and viewshed review 12001, 186 Elm Street, applied for by Mitchell and Jamie Wallace, with the changing of number six that. And to look at the width of the drive to make sure that the person in a one-car garage can get out. Thank you. That's it.
What about the setbacks?
I thought that was included in number
right
six.
Right now it says, no, six is the deed restriction.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, and to move the setback
interior setback
feet,
from
yeah.
10 to 8 feet, the interior between the two
right.
buildings.
So the front setback's at 17,
right.
and the interior between the buildings is 8, and the side is 5.
Okay. I'll second that. Any discussion?
I think that was it.
Yep. Debbie, can I have roll call, please?
Commissioner King?
Yes.
Vice Chair Barnage?
Yes.
Commissioner Martin?
Yes.
And Commissioner
Creation of Development Code Amendment Number 12-003. A cleanup amendment addressing habitable structure setbacks, separate utility meters, temporary banner regulations in the D2.11 overlay district, and temporary use permit fee waiver authority for nonprofit charitable events. The applicant is the City of Arroyo Grande, and the location is citywide. And Matthew is going to give us this staff report as well. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Vice Chair Barnage and members of the Commission. So this is a cleanup ordinance. We're addressing four different sections of the municipal code. I did hear some discussion from the committee or from the commission members as to protocol for reviewing the ordinance. There is a recommendation at the end of the staff at the end of staff's presentation on how to do that, and so hopefully that'll address any concerns there. So there have been several items identified by both staff and members of the public. Call them deficiencies of the development code, if you will, in the recent months. One of them is the setback requirements from legally non-conforming habitable structures. Another is separate utility meters for second so I'll hit each one of these in order. The first is the habitable structure setbacks. Older portions of the city have areas where property lines have been surveyed inaccurately, and over time as they were resurveyed, we find that, you know, an entire side of the street might have property lines that are 1 foot off of where they should be, or, you know, other building permit or, you know, building plan type issues where older building plans weren't drawn to the exact same specificity as they are now. And So over time, buildings have become legally nonconforming, where once those property lines are truly established, we find that there are structures within the setback areas. This can create problems, not so much when constructing projects that require a building permit, because they can be conditioned to have building separation, but other things not requiring permits, such as fences, accessory structures under 120 square feet, they can be put almost right on the property line, and this can render some nonconforming structures of these legally nonconforming habitable structures on adjacent parcels. There was some retooling, because at first when staff drafted it, we kind of realized that it went citywide, and so it is a little bit more restrictive just for the residential zones. In terms of separate utility meters, the original intent of single meters for second residential dwelling units was to control the proliferation of those units, as well as protect the character of existing single-family neighborhoods. Over time, state mandates have required the removal of barriers to the development of affordable housing units. Secondary dwelling units are considered an affordable housing choice. Separate utility meters can actually reduce utility costs. Staff did an estimate based on Pacific Gas and Electric utility calculations, and having split meters in the peak of summer can actually save quite a bit of money. So the proposed ordinance would allow property owner choice regarding second meters. It's written in such a way that it doesn't require one, it doesn't require two, it kind of gives choice to the property owner. Back in June of 2011, in November, I believe it was, the owners of the auto dealerships near the village contacted staff and actually submitted a letter regarding the issues created by these new regulations. They have certain, they have pressure from the actual car manufacturers to purchase and display sale banners for 4th of July, Memorial Day, all these other kind of sales events. And the new regulations actually kind of really prohibit that. So staff brought that to the council's attention, and the city council directed staff to draft an ordinance addressing the issues. So the proposed ordinance and attached resolution, exhibits A and B in your Planning Commission resolution, they amend the D2.2 overlay guidelines. This allows the car lots, two banners, 48 square feet each, displayed 30 days out of every 60 days. This is an increase basically in the number, the size, and the display period. However, the display period was requested. In terms of temporary use permit fee waivers, so only City Council can waive these processing fees. Currently, they're $152 per temporary use permit. There are certain charitable events, such as recently a benefit barbecue to specifically raise money for somebody involved in a quad accident. These upfront costs can be, you know, a little intimidating to people trying to put on a charitable event. The proposed regulations allow the community development director to waive processing fees basically over the counter upon written written request by the applicant of the temporary use permit. One thing to make note of is that neither nonprofit nor charitable events are defined in the municipal code. Currently the only criteria available is actually a city council waiver form. And these do not apply evenly to all events. It does indicate a lot of use of city facilities, which some of these events don't take place on city facilities, such as Soto Sports Complex. located on a city-owned property. So that is something to keep in mind during our discussion. So as I mentioned, there are some additional inclusions to consider to the draft ordinance that's in front of you tonight. The development code, one is to allow separate sewer laterals and connections for secondary units. This was actually brought up by a member of the staff advisory committee. I did not include it in the draft because it was already in process of being distributed out, and staff kind of wanted Planning Commission's feedback on that. The second point is actually either the inclusion of definitions or creation of definitions in the beginning of the municipal code and referencing those within the new provisions for temporary use permit fee waivers, addressing the nonprofit and charitable events issue. So the project has been categorically exempt, determined to be categorically exempt per sections 15061B3 and 15308 of CEQA. These refer to actions by regulatory agencies for regarding the proposed ordinance in front of you. And so here comes the recommendation. It's recommended that following questions of staff, initial questions of staff by the commission, that we allow the public to speak on the proposed ordinance as a whole, because each person has a certain period of time they can address whatever they want to in that period of time. However, when it comes back for the commission review, it's recommended that they discuss each portion of the ordinance individually. This allows clarification to staff on, you know, where you guys are going and maybe some of the additions or subtractions necessary. And then finally, make a recommendation to the City Council to introduce the proposed ordinance. Currently, it's tentatively scheduled to be introduced at the August 14th City Council meeting. And I believe that concludes the staff report, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Matthew. Does anyone have any questions? I guess we'll ask all of our questions, and then we can take the comments separately. Is that the way you thought it would work, John? I mean, you want to just ask questions about everything right now? Let's start with the habitable structure setbacks. Does anyone have questions of Matthew? I have one. So I'm a little bit confused because if someone's going to put up a fence, they're just going to put it up. They don't look over and see that there's a non-conforming garage that's too close to their fence they're going to build. So is this going to be complaint-driven, or how are we going to police? And then, wait, before you answer that, I'm just thinking out loud. So because there's these non-conforming structures, then the person sort of on the other side of the property line suffers a little bit because they don't get to build what they want on their property line. They have to back it off their property line. I mean, is that sort of, that's just what I was thinking, is if I went out to build something and the city said, no, you can't because he's too close, and we know he's not allowed to be that close, but because he is, you have to back everything up.
Correct. And so that gets into the issue of legally nonconforming versus illegal. On the assumption that one property line was at, you know, X marks the spot, mm-hmm. And then finding out that, oh, no, it's over. So it's, while the property owner, who you could say is being, you know, almost punished, right, for, you know, wanting to build, let's say, a fence on the new property line,
right,
they're also gaining a lot of property down the entire stretch by having a new, you know, extra foot over. And also, I mean, I think the argument could be made that it's also unfair to somebody who buys a house who all of a sudden finds out that their property line is now closer to their residence, to all of a sudden have a bedroom be no longer a bedroom, it can't be used as such.
Right.
So it,
okay.
And it should be noted that we tossed around the idea of, you know, requiring non-buildable easements in that area or lot line adjustments, and those are much more difficult to come by in terms of this type of situation.
Okay, and then it will be, complaint driven. How will they know that they can't? Okay.
Yes, like several things within the.
Okay, I think that was my only question on that one. John, do you have questions on this one?
No, just a comment about that. A person that living there and somebody comes and builds a thing too close to him because of fire getting out of the bedroom and everything, a lot of people wouldn't even realize that that was that they had an alternative to call and make them not do that. I would assume that somebody would say, gosh, that's awful close to my house, you know, but I don't know that they would know. So complaint-driven, I think, is not going to solve the problem, but I don't know what else to do. I mean, you can't go around and look at everybody building a fence. I just think that the people won't realize that they have a choice.
No, I think you're right. These are types of building activities that don't trigger. And so that's the purpose.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, John. Jennifer, any questions on this one?
Yeah, can you get, I'm kind of where Kristen was, trying to understand, we're talking about habitable structures versus a shed or something not habitable, but is there an example that set this, I mean, can you give me a couple scenarios that?
There is an example that kind of spurred this, and I believe there is a member of the audience here to speak on that portion of it. It might be better left member of the audience to discuss it.
Okay, that's fine. And you said a little while ago that somebody gained a foot, and I lost you there for a second. If somebody has to move their fence over because this house is too close to them, do we?
Correct. So let me clarify that. In terms of gaining a foot, we're talking about the property owner whose property line is actually moving closer toward the habitable structure on the adjacent property. So, you know, that does not have that issue actually gains, let's say, a foot by having their new property boundary, which was originally supposed to be in the middle, shifted closer to the adjacent parcel on that side. Granted, if it's completely down the entire side of the street, then they gain on one side and lose on the other. So it's kind of a...
So that's a scenario if the property line is not where they thought it was.
Correct.
And it was closer. But it could be that somebody's just built closer to the property line, and then I want to go put a fence up on my property line, but now I can't. So I either have to, like, zigzag it or do something else.
Exactly. And that would kind of get into the whole legally versus illegally nonconforming. I mean, if the person who intruded into the setback and is too close to the actual property line now did it without permits or did it with a permit but then did some extra additions that were not permitted, that's when the city could actually say, this isn't permitted, it's too close to the property line, you need to remedy this situation. Does that answer that kind of question?
Yes, I think so. Thank you.
Okay, Lisa, do you have any questions?
Okay.
on the first item we're discussing, which is the habitable structure setbacks.
Thank you, and my name is Candy Brill. My name is Candy Brill, and I live on Whiteley Street, just down in the village here. And I purchased my home 20 years ago, and all the fences were in place. And they've been there since 1955 when the homes were built, and the homes were built, you know, in their spots where they are. Well, we've come to find out that the property lines are off, and off like 2.5 feet. So if my neighbors decided to put up a fence, it would be 11.5 inches from my windows of a bedroom. So that would totally close off that bedroom because of the safety law of 3 feet. But because there's never been a fence there, saying that it should just stay the way it is isn't like anyone's losing anything, because property, but it would have to jag, you know, so that those bedrooms would be protected and still usable. Otherwise, they could condemn my home. And nobody knew about this. I asked the person I bought the house from, and she said, no, they had no knowledge of it. They put a big addition on in 1986, and she said they didn't know that the property lines were off at all either. In fact, there's a cement curb in the front that separates our properties, and that's wrong. So it's a hard thing for neighbors to have to work on this kind of a situation, but it really would be detrimental to my home if I would have to close off that bedroom, or it would be condemned. So I appreciate your work on this and taking the time to think about it. So thank you.
Thank you. Oh, sorry. We have a Jennifer has a question.
Sorry. So is it a side setback we're talking about? Is it?
Yes, it's on the side yard. So our yard's on the side. In fact, I landscaped in between them for both of us. They gave
Is that the plan? They want to move the fence.
They may
11 inches away from your house.
No, there is no fence.
There's no fence now, but they want to put a fence
there. But if
there.
They wanted to, I'd be in trouble. And so I started working on this with them beforehand, saying, you know, can we figure out a situation where we could make sure nothing would be built there, and they wouldn't work with me on that. Although nothing's been there.
How long ago did you buy your property?
20 years.
20 years. And at the time, did you have the, you know, the property lines drawn? I know the house that I live in now, when I bought it, there was a fence up. And when we bought the house, we realized the fence was 2 feet over on our property. And I said, before I buy this house, I want that fence moved. I want those two feet back.
I never knew about it. And
because it, you know, it shrunk our property. Right. So but you didn't have that when you purchased. So nobody.
Everyone thought everything was just fine.
Does anyone, any commissioners have any other questions? No? Okay, thank you. Okay, then we'll go ahead and close that and bring it back to the commission. Okay, thank you. Jennifer?
So we're making a recommendation to council on this ordinance. Is that what we're doing?
That's correct.
Okay. I understand the situation, but I wonder if there's another way to work that out. I'm a little concerned about saying you can't put a fence on your property line because of the other 100 examples of what could happen in the other direction. So I understand this situation, and I wouldn't want a fence there in an existing neighborhood like that, but I'm not sure what the right solution is. So I have a little concern. I'm not an expert in property lines and easements and that, but I think once you it makes me a little nervous of all the other examples once you start saying you can't do that and you need to move it over, and then I just envision like all these fences all over the place and different, I don't know.
Jogged all over.
Yeah, so I'm not sure. I don't really have an answer.
Either fence is not on true property lines, or they could have little jogs in them. It's also, given that it is a current example or a situation going on now, it's also not necessarily considered to happen quite frequently. It's only in the older portions of the city. Most other residential areas actually are constructed correctly within setbacks. So it's a finite area of the city that this is really going to happen in, and we're not necessarily expecting very many cases to come up. I don't know if that necessarily is your concern, but.
No, I appreciate that, and that's why I wonder if there's another, you guys have been looking at it longer, and I read through it and tried to get it, if there's another avenue or something. It seems broad, so the problem you're defining seems specific, but that the ordinance of not being able to put a fence within legally non-conforming habitable structure seems really broad. So.
Okay. Thank you, Jennifer. Lisa?
I do have the issue, too, because when you buy that issue, and maybe it's the lawyer in me, I get out there and look at exactly where the lines are, and I said, I want those 2 feet back before I buy this property, or get an easement in place before you buy the property. I don't know that we need to, if a fence is there, I know people often assume that's the property line, but I think you need to look into it. And I kind of agree with Jennifer. I hate to, all those other people out there, all of a sudden now they can't put fences up and things. Because it would be a harsh result, and I'm sympathetic to that. But I do kind of feel like you should be on notice when you buy property where your lines are and what the implications are. So I don't know either. I know I'm kind of with Jennifer. I wonder if there's I think the way to do it is you get some type of it's not necessarily an easement, though, because if they're taking back the property that's theirs, I mean, I guess you're getting permission not for them not to do something on their own property. It does trouble me a little bit to go ahead and take this approach to it. If it doesn't come up very often, then maybe it is a situation where when it does come
I kind of feel a little bit like Lisa and Jennifer, but we can't make someone tear down their house or their garage, and we can't have people that can't escape in a fire out their window because the fence is right next to the window. So we know we can't do those two things. So, you have looked at this, and maybe I think this might be the only way, and maybe hopefully there's not a lot of properties out here that we're going to see this, but I don't know what else you can do. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, I can give you a little glimpse of some of the thought process that went into this and some of the other avenues we looked at. It might clarify a few things.
Okay.
And we did talk about doing lot line adjustments and easements, and I think that resulted in that is more difficult than this. And so it's kind of like balancing the hardships. On the one hand, we have people who buy property and it's legally non-conforming. They didn't do anything wrong. And then we have other people who essentially they could put a fence up, rendering the adjacent structure. one, they're more permanent than prohibiting, you know, a 3-foot fence. They could still pursue a lot line adjustment or an easement, but this seemed to be the path of least resistance under the circumstances.
Okay. Thank you for that. I agree. I don't think there's a perfect solution. So we have to just work with what's out there. And so I'm ready to move forward tonight on that. So we're not going to actually have a motion. We're just going to move on to the next one. Okay. It's a little bit confusing, but I think that will work. So are we okay on that one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, done discussion that one. All righty. So that takes us to the separate electric, gas, and water meters, and then also the separate sewer laterals to discuss that as well. Okay. Let me ask a question on that. The sewer laterals, is there any disadvantage to – that would just be for new construction, correct?
Mostly,
okay.
Yes.
Okay. There's no disadvantages. That's
Vice Chair Barnes,
yes.
I just want to add one thing. In that the sewer lateral issue wasn't on our radar as nearly to the extent of the billing issues that have come up with utility billing. And that's so I just wanted to make you aware that's why we didn't originally include it. Again, we're looking at this because we've been getting complaints from folks that have second units that are just struggling paying their bills because they're getting in the higher tiered billing rates, and these units are supposed to provide some benefit and affordability of housing stock in the city, and we're required by the state to always continue looking at this and remove any obstacles. So sewer laterals didn't raise to that level, and that's why it wasn't included.
Okay. So do any commissioners have any questions of staff on this one, on the separate meters? Yeah, go ahead.
Going back to the sewer lateral thing, when by having both of them paying for the same sewer cost, sewer transportation cost?
Do you mean having two water meters but having the same lateral, and so they're both paying for the use of one lateral?
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Do you have a illustration of this matrix you gave us on the gas bill and water?
Unfortunately, no. I thought about putting it in there, and it slipped my mind.
Okay.
Being quite honest with you.
That's a little strange to me. When you have the gas-heated house, home, and the cost of the one residence, one meter thing, for example, the winter when you would be using all your gas to heat, and then in the summer it's higher. All these prices are electric, whether it's says gas heated or not.
Correct. So they are electric, that is a little misleading. I'll admit that. So they are all electric costs,
yeah,
for the two separate categories.
And we're assuming that in these prices that everybody has air conditioning. Now, there's an awful lot of homes, mine, that doesn't have air conditioning and never thought I needed it. But so to use these as a general thing for the justification of the cost, kind of misleading. I'm not against having the 2 meters. I understand the problem. Teresa, the house on Sunrise or Sunset, whatever one it was, that we had such a problem over, they built a second unit in the back and had a discussion. How did that ever turn out? Did they put in a second meter or not?
Residents that are looking at this ordinance and they're hoping that second meters will become available.
There's a lot of background to this, and I don't know whether we need to go into it or not, but one of them was on the second units was that when there's a fire, the first thing the fire department does is come and shut off the meter, pull it, so that they're not spraying water on some thing. Well, if you have another meter someplace, that means that part of that structure or the back structure or whatever, however it's laid out, still has electricity and it's not safe for them. And that was one of the reasons that we tried to keep the 1 meter situation was for fire safety. But because of the cost of how this compounding is running, I think that it probably needs to be changed. And it all started back when we were doing rentals. Especially when you buy into a neighborhood expecting to have single-family dwellings in that, so that's part of the history of why it was like that, at least as I recall. I'm not going to vote against this, but because I think it cost-wise it's very advantageous to the people that have second units. I just don't want to come up with something that we're not seeing that may be a problem, and I don't think it really affects a lot of units because we just don't have that many, and I probably will start getting more as time goes on to get our lower cost housing rental.
And if I may speak to your concern regarding the fires, Commissioner Keene, Chief Aaron has
Yeah, I know that's why they do that at apartment complexes, because they're all in a group. I don't think that's probably one of the letters in here. That's not going to help them and their thing if the meters have to be together. The electric seems to be the big problem. So I'm in favor of going forward with this.
Thanks, Sean. Jennifer, do you want to just do questions and then comments?
I don't have any questions. I don't have a problem with the 2 meters. I think it should be that way. Actually, I thought it was that way. Except for the water. I knew that was single, but I think it's great. I do not have a problem.
think it's a great idea. My parents actually have a secondary residence, and I think it will cause the tenants to be more conscious of what they use, because there is a lot of waste. When someone else is paying for your utilities, you might have some people in there, it's like, oh, turn the heater on, who cares? So I think that, and that's smart, maybe we'll have less water that people use in the city and electric and gas. So I'm totally for it, and I'm ready to move forward on that tonight as well. Okay, that brings us to temporary use permit fee waivers for nonprofit and charities, and then you also wanted us to discuss definitions maybe of nonprofit and charitable entities. I have a question about that. Obviously, for the nonprofits, they have a 501c3 or 501c4. They have a number associated with it. We all know that means they're a verified nonprofit. But when you have a barbecue for someone who's gotten hurt, then that's just, so has staff thought of any way to sort of regulate that or make sure that it's...
And that's part of the reason why we didn't actually address So we wanted to allow, you know, some leniency in terms of how that is applied, especially to people who just put on a benefit barbecue, for example. However, that also kind of gets into the, then it's, I'm blanking on the word, but it's not a set in stone, here's how these fees are waived. Yeah, it's more of a discretionary waiver. Talking to the city attorney, he said, you know, he said you could go either way. You could either leave it open-ended or define it. Obviously, if we had a definition in the municipal code already, that would be great. But also, the like I said in the staff report, the current fee waiver form is not, which is not in the staff report, it's not very fair to people who just start up a benefit barbecue to raise money for something, because it gives extra credit to the reduction of fees for using city property and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I know when I was on Parks and Rec, we'd get a lot of those. Is that the form you're referring to?
Yes.
Where they check the different boxes?
Correct.
Of the supplies? Okay, I was...
And then... all the rest, it could be discretionary from the director or something like that. Maybe that defines it a tiny bit, so that's kind of an easy way to say yes, and then that's just an idea I'm throwing out there. So questions and then comments on this one, John? Nothing? Jennifer? No comments? Okay, yay or nay?
I'm having trouble just... are you looking for a definition of charitable, or, I mean, it seems just kind of makes sense to me if it's a nonprofit or somebody doing something for a charity, which.
Exactly, and that's why staff is having an issue approaching that.
So as written in the proposed ordinance, it's not specifically defined, and we're proposing to bring it forward like this to see how it works. I'm not anticipating a whole lot of trouble, but there might be a few gray areas, and I'll just have to make that call.
Are you? So is it whether it's somebody's better at coming up with definitions than I am, but nonprofit or charitable sounds clear. I mean, I'm all for definitions in the development code because it helps people on my end figure out what you're supposed to do, but I think it has to be staff's discretion. If it's a charitable event, it's a charitable event.
Okay. Thank you. Jennifer,
Lisa, I have to be honest, this really troubled me when I read it. I read it instantly. I thought, what standards? What's she going to use? What is her checkoff list? Who's she going to look to? And, you know, are you just going to grant everybody that asks for it? And if not, then those who get denied, what are they going to do? What are you going to defend yourself with? This really troubled me of all of these. And I know I was on Parks and Rec, and we saw a lot of those requests to use city buildings and things for different charitable events. And there was a checkoff list, and it was, you know, if you meet, I think it was three of these criteria, then you automatically get it. If you meet two, you can get a partial fee waiver. And it was kind of a sliding scale. And then if they didn't meet them, but they still thought they should get it, they came before Parks. I don't know. I mean, I think there should be some discretion, but it does make me nervous that I think it might put the city in a little bit more difficult position to defend itself if we do deny some. It says it has to be upon written request. Is there going to be a particular form they fill out or just any scrawled handwritten request? Is there criteria there?
So there currently is the checklist form, which can be used. We can also model something after that form as we go forward to kind of make it fair across the board. Also, in previous instances, we've had applicants who do just submit a letter saying, here's what I'm doing, here's where my profits are going, here's why I think I should have a fee waiver. Sometimes that comes with the application. Sometimes that comes after we tell them, you know, you have to actually submit in writing why you want it.
So at this point, you are anticipating either would be acceptable, they could come in, because there isn't a particular form for this. Well, there is to go before the city council, but for this new modification, would you be anticipating a particular form? They would come into city hall.
See which way might to approach it.
And I could see making it somewhat open-ended. You've already listed a lot of things, benefit barbecues, I think, sports, different things like that, and say, or other appropriate events, something like that. So you could leave a little room for discretion. I think I would just like to see it, and I don't know if it needs to be defined more, but I'd like to see the process a little bit more. So you have to have written request, fill out the submittal, and you'll have so many days to respond. That's the lawyer in me, but I like things to be very orderly and spelled out. I do think it would be great. I agree that there are a lot of events that shouldn't have to pay that fee, and having to wait to go before the city council is probably an onerous burden for them. So this would be a good step. So I do support it that way, but I would like a little more definition.
I agree that the fee should be waived for nonprofits or charitable events. That's a no-brainer. But I wonder, I mean, I'm a little in an accident. Okay. I mean, how do we really know? And I don't know. I mean, maybe we're over-worrying this, but I just don't know how the community development director is going to be able to verify. I mean, it's maybe just because they feel like the person's really going to do what they say they're going to do. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, I would hate to think that there are people out there that would abuse the system like that, but there are people out there that would abuse the system like that. And that's why that's why we're bringing it up. And
that's why we're talking about it.
Exactly.
Given the discussion, what we could do as we proceed to council, if depending on the recommendation by this commission, is we have actually a fairly extensive temporary use permit application form, so we'll have a good idea of the nature of the event and the applicant's information on there already. We can add the form modified from the existing recreation form on there as well. that we will have, you know, the signed application, project description, benefit description.
People asking for it, but I think it needs to be a little bit more defined on the charitable end, just, you know, so that we're not collecting money we should be collecting. We don't, city's not rich by any means, so. Okay, are we done with that one?
I have one question.
John, okay. You're the best.
Well, you guys remind me of things to say.
Aren't you glad?
At the first of the presentation, I thought you stated that only the city council can waive fees. How was the Parks Department waiving those fees?
The actual processing fees are only able to be waived by the city council. The actual parks facility uses can be waived by the Parks and Recreation Commission.
The rental fees.
Mm. I was trying to get Lisa in trouble.
I'm glad you clarified.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Okay. Now we're moving on to the next one, which is large-scale automobile retail banners. I guess we can go with question and comments, or if we have mobile dealers requested is different than maybe that you said you ratcheted back the time. So we're giving them 36 months a year is what we're giving them, which is a lot more than I know the rest of the temporary banners in town. So they came to us with a request that said that the franchise agreement that they have requires them to be up a certain amount of time. We ratcheted back. So how did we ratchet it back if they said they had to be up a certain amount of time? So do we really know what is set in stone that they have to have their banners out for a certain amount of time to adhere to that franchise agreement?
In the letter that was submitted to the City Council when this issue was brought up, it said a reasonable solution for a larger business in the city, such as the car lots and such, allow 40 square foot banners, allow up to a 90 day maximum display of any particular banner. So any one banner could be up 90 days, and allow up 2 to 3 banners per lot. So allowing too much flexibility to where it is unenforceable and that sort of thing.
Okay, so the banners that the temporary sign ordinance that we agreed to last year, how long can they be up?
24 square foot banners. One 24 square foot banner can be up for a 30 day period within every 90 days. So that,
the year.
Basically, all together. It can be broken up within that 90-day period, so you could do 10 days for the first 30 days, 10 days in the second 30 days, 10 days in the last 30 days, but a total of 30 days per 90-day period. So this kind of goes from a third of the year, like you said, to a half a year.
And it's double the size?
Yes.
Okay, and then what's staff's feeling on setting a precedent when someone else says, hey, how come he gets to have his banner up for half the year and they picked on
large properties and they're single retail uses on these large properties. So we actually first approached it looking at all large retail properties in the city. That got a little complicated, shopping centers and But it did narrow, you know, looking at the unique aspects of these car lots and important service they provide for the city is that they are single retail uses on large lots in one neighborhood that has a design overlay district already upon it. So that's why we feel fairly comfortable that we could make this unique to this request and this type of land use.
Okay, thanks, Risa. John, you want to go with questions or comments on that?
It seems like the discussion I heard at council meeting when this came up was that the banners they were requesting were for national promotions, not local promotions, and they were required to put them. Whatever promotion, then I think they should be allowed. But if they're going to just use this as for local events and things, then that's a separate issue, I think.
But how would we know if the banner we drive by, it's a national event or it's something that's unique to their business? I mean, how?
You're going to see the ad on TV.
I don't watch TV. I don't have a TV with cable.
Exactly.
John will keep track.
And that does obviously create the enforcement issue from city's standpoint. Whereas just allowing the two banners for 60 days per year, we're still part of the banner regulations that went through last summer were that they have to be registered with the Community Development Department. That way we can track them.
Right.
The car lot owners did say that's a little unnecessary, it's a little, you know, that's too much, but we still feel that that is one form of
John made it more complicated. When we looked at this last time, I was amazed at how complicated banners can get. But so it was going from 24 square feet to 48 square feet total. So up to two signs, or was it each?
Each.
Okay.
So potentially a total of 96 square feet overall. If you had two banners up.
248 square feet.
Correct.
Okay, got it. I don't have any questions. I don't. I see what John's saying. I don't know how we mitigate that. I guess if it's, I think we've limited it enough. I'm okay with it.
Okay.
Sorry,
okay,
it's not much.
I'm okay with it, too. I do worry a little bit about the precedent we're setting, but I think that traffic way, station way, is a unique part of the city, that it is where the car dealers are located. I think it's. I think that makes it distinct enough to justify, so I'm fine with it.
Okay, thank you, Lisa. I'll go ahead with what the commission's will is. I'm not really sold that they need to have these banners up because they're a franchise and their agreement says they have to have them up because they asked for more and we gave them less and supposedly they may be okay with that. I think they're important in the community for, they're the only car dealerships we have. I'm still not sold on how effective banners are, big, huge banners. I think that we all know that there's cars for sale down there. And so 6 months a year to have 96 square feet of banners up there, I think it's overkill, especially because we're going a third of the year for everyone else. And I think that that's working, and I think people are coming in and applying, and I think people, I actually have noticed a big difference in the city for code enforcement, maybe, is that who's enforcing that, that you go to other cities and you notice our city looks a lot nicer with not all the proliferation of the banners and the balloons and the flags and everything. So I think that it's working. It was maybe painful to begin with, but if we have a system in place, I think it's working. So I'm not real wild about this, but if you think we can ratchet it back anymore, if there's any way that we can, you know, I don't know how the council will feel. So I'm sure the car dealership people will show up to the council meeting. So let's see. So okay, those were all of our cleanup amendments. So now how do we want to take, it's just one motion, one resolution?
Probably going to want to do it in separate motions, okay. Make it a little cleaner, because that way then you can address each. If you had want to change it at all, you can do it individually.
Okay. Okay, so we want to start. Does someone want to make the motion for the habitable structure setback? And we'll start with that.
I don't know that I'm ready to make a motion, but it does trouble me, but I think that the other options seem to be harsher and more difficult, so I will support it as written and hope that it doesn't create more issues for other property owners, but yeah, so I know we had some discussion before, and if that helps someone else make a motion or not.
I mean, I was looking at the statement, legally non-conforming habitable. I think you have all the words in there that I would not want to see somebody's bedroom become unusable. So I'm willing to support it. I think that, I don't know, maybe there's a little more... council can look at that a little bit closer, just in terms of, is it for the length of the structure? Is it sleeping areas? Is it, you know, maybe just, I don't know. But I'm willing to support it at this level, and I think the background you've done and throwing out the other options that you've discussed is helpful. To try to make that decision, so I'll move forward.
John, do you want to try a motion? No?
Nope.
Well, do we just set it here?
So I will move that, that we recommend to the City Council, I guess that's what we're doing, we're recommending to the City Council that they adopt the amended portion of Title 16 of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code regarding setbacks between habitable structures on adjacent lots.
Second. Any discussion on that one? Okay. Debbie, can I have a roll call, please?
Commissioner Sparrow?
Yes.
Vice Chair Barnage?
Yes.
Commissioner Martin?
Yes.
And Commissioner Keene?
Yes.
Okay. Now we will go to the separate utility meters, electric, gas, and water meters. Would anyone like to craft a motion on that one?
Is there any crafting? Can I just read?
Well, I don't think there's any crafting.
Is there any
actually.
Issue?
I think it's straightforward.
Can I
was just trying to be fancy.
First,
what, John? Lisa?
Can I have a question first?
Sure.
When we divide the water meters and require fire sprinkler systems, the water meters automatically have to go larger for the flow, mm-hmm. And that, once you change the flow rate of the meter connection, the price goes up. So price for the water.
Oh.
Doesn't it? I think on the bill it says a 5/8 meter of.
It does. Yeah, it's varied off size of the meter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess that wasn't a question. I was just going to make a statement. But
yeah, you're right. This will give the choice to a property owner in their circumstances and whether they want to choose to have that second meter and maybe have an effect on the tiered rates, but also may have another effect on their water bill.
Yeah, but don't they automatically have to go to a larger meter when they sprinkle them, and these mostly are sprinkled?
Yes, sprinkler structures do have to go to 1-inch water meters.
That's all the questions I have.
Did you do a study on the water meter to see if it's cost effective to add a water meter? It's not really your job. I
did talk to the water billing staff at the city. She did explain that having two units on 1 meter, so a primary unit and a secondary unit, automatically puts them in the multifamily tiered rate, depending on the size of the meter. Doing this would convert both of those to single family, to the single family rates for both meters. Again, it's kind of just giving them the leeway to do it if they'd rather do that, if they'd rather have 2 meters instead of having 1 meter. So it's. That's why we are leaving it open-ended, to kind of, you know, give them the option of whether or not they really want to do that.
Right, because you still get doubly impact charged if you have 1 meter and 2 residences.
Correct.
You pay double sewer, double, and you pay those impact fees on 1 meter.
Mm-hmm. And as Vice Chair Barnage said, it could promote, you know, conservation and that sort of thing, if tenants have their own separate meter and they are paying their own separate water rates. So there's an incentive for property owners to do it, and there's also, you know, a disincentive for property owners to do it. So it's kind of, as Teresa said, it's a balance for the property owner in their current situation as to whether or not they want to do it.
When you go to 2 meters for one property, I know right now the meters are put together, so you only have one tap off the main. Does that mean that the property owner would have to change that tap clear to the main to get the amount of flow for 2 sprinklered systems? Because that.
I honestly don't know the correct answer to that, but I don't think so. That's my.
It's going to have to need a separate lateral all the way to the street.
Oh, yeah, you do that. But, I mean, the meters are at the street. The right. Line from the meter to the main may not be sufficient.
Right,
For 2 sprinklers.
Right.
And
I just wonder who has to pay for that.
And it, if, like, for example, if a property is added onto and fire sprinklers are required, it is on the property owner to upgrade the size of the water meter to support that. So if a structure is already built, if a secondary unit's already built, and then they decide that they arbitrarily want to switch to 2 meters, they would be responsible for installing the new doing all the upgrades. But again, it's not mandating that they have to. It's just giving them the leeway that if they decide that they will have to pay, you know, all of it.
Yeah.
I move the Planning Commission of the City of Arroyo Grande recommend, an ordinance of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande, amending portions of Title 16 of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code, separate utility meters for secondary dwelling units.
Second. Any discussion? We have roll call, please, Debbie.
Commissioner Martin?
Yes.
Commissioner Barnage?
Yes.
Commissioner Keene?
Yes.
And Commissioner Spiro?
Yes. That takes us to the next item that we're going to discuss, which is the temporary use permit fee waivers. And does anyone want to try a motion with that one? Because I think, or we might want to add some.
I don't know. I spoke a lot about my feelings. I don't know if anyone else agrees or not that you'd like to see it spelled out more or not. So I'll put that out there. If anybody does, I could try to craft one that does, but I don't want to do so.
Let's try. I mean, let's
okay. Then I'll move that the Planning Commission, the City of Arroyo Grande, recommend that the City Council of Arroyo Grande amend portion of Title 16 of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code regarding temporary use permit fee waiver authority for nonprofit charitable events, but I would like to see some more guidelines created regarding what is an appropriate nonprofit charitable event, perhaps using the current form with some modifications to make it so that it's not solely limited to city buildings, but any city property.
Second.
Keep
forgetting that now I'm running the meeting, so I'm quiet after that. Do we have any discussion?
You know, I just sit here waiting for Liz to do something.
Okay, Debbie, can I roll call, please?
Commissioner Spiro?
Yes.
Commissioner Barnage?
Yes.
Commissioner King?
Yes.
And Commissioner Martin?
Yes. Okay, now we're to the next item, large-scale automobile retail banners. Would anybody like to try a motion on that?
I move the Planning Commission of the City of Rio Grande recommend the City Council adopt an ordinance approving Develop Code Amendment Number 12-003, amending various portions of Title 16 of the Municipal Code regarding. Where are we? I know what it's regarding, temporary use and banners.
Large-scale automobile.
And miscellaneous signs, is that it?
Large-scale automobile retail banners, is that what you said, Jennifer?
No, I said miscellaneous signs because I was looking for what the word
So the use. Miscellaneous sign portion is actually the ordinance that will refer to the design guidelines. So staff would recommend including both the ordinance and the resolution, Exhibit A and Exhibit B.
Okay.
Which I realize might complicate things.
Yes, you totally confused me. So miscellaneous signs and what was the other thing?
And amendments to the D2.11 overlay district design guidelines.
Oh, amendments to the what he said, 11 design guidelines overlay district. Yes.
Second.
Is there any discussion on that? Okay, Debbie, can I have a roll call, please?
Commissioner Martin?
Yes.
Commissioner King?
Yes.
Commissioner Spiro?
Yes.
And Commissioner Barnage?
Yes. That convoluted one. Okay. Oh, good. Good break. Okay. That brings us to 9 non-public hearing items. We have none. And then item number 10, notice of administrative decisions. We have one, which was a temporary use permit, 12-012, Jillian Ellison on 173 Pine Street. Temporary use of commercial coach as a residence at a residential construction site. Does anyone have any questions about that? No? Just... I always ask this. How long is it going to be there?
I was going to ask for you, but I thought I'd wait.
I'll check the approval letter real quick if you'll give me one moment. Now I really wish I would have looked it up before the meeting.
Still a building permit issue. No.
I believe it was conditioned to expire within 6 months or at the conclusion of the building project, whichever comes first.
Okay. Have we ever seen that before where people stay in? I assume
yes.
It's a trailer or something.
Yes, exactly. And it recently happened. I forget which street it was on, but it was on the west side of the city in one of the residential zones where the main structure was completely being remodeled. And it was the same condition to be abandoned after 6 months. And at that time, they can come back and reapply for, here it is. So it's conditioned to expire on December 20th of this year because it was approved on June 20th.
Okay.
So, or again, if the building project is done first. If for some reason it goes longer, they can reapply for it and we can reapprove for another 6 months.
And then that brings us to commission communications. Anyone have any comments?
Just about the economic element committee. It's still meeting. There is a draft that's being circulated, and I think a final draft will be coming before us soon. If anybody wants to see the draft, I'd be happy to email it to you, or I think Teresa could too in advance. If anyone have any questions.
Is it on the website?
We circulated more of an administrative draft to committee members to take to different committees and stakeholder groups for comments. We are incorporating those comments together. We'll meet one more time and distribute the final draft of the public review draft, and that will be, I'll be taking it, shopping it with the chamber, as well as this commission prior to bringing it forward to City Council.
Okay. Thank you, Teresa. I'm going to be absent August 7th, and I told Brian that, but I think John might be gone too. So I want to make sure that there's quorum. And that brings us to item number 12, staff communications. Teresa, anything?
Just as you know, we have Roy Grundy and Bloom judges coming into town next week, and so you probably noticed all the volunteers fixing up the city for that. So that's going on in the near future. And our bike plan is going to City Council next week. The economic development element coming to you soon. And the other advanced planning or program project we're working on is, again, the Bridge Street Bridge project. We had another meeting with consultants. They are pursuing feasibility studies for rehabilitation or replacement in those scenarios. So once we get further along in that process, I'll come to you with status update.
Teresa, a question on that. Isn't that deemed a historic structure?
It is, and it's and this is going forward. The project is going forward with a full awareness and the bulk of the project. There's lots of engineering, of course, with the bridge, but the it's just as important. We're evaluating the impacts to the historic bridge structure with those different scenarios.
So you said replacement, but not necessarily because it's historic, but we have to balance making sure it's safe with...
Right.
Okay.
It's a safety and historic preservation balancing project.
Okay. And that brings us to item 13, adjournment.
So moved.
Second.